take your seats. We'd like to get started. All right. Good morning. Ah, come on, guys.
Good morning.
Thank you. That's more like it. My name is Ali Katao, and I'm a board member at Leadership Austin, and I'm also president and CEO of Encotech Engineering Consultants. And I would like to thank you for joining us for this Growing Divide series. We are completely sold out today. And, yeah, so kudos to you folks for being engaged and concerned about our community, and kudos to Leadership Austin staff for amazing marketing. So give yourselves a big hand of applause. Our panel discussion today is going to be about affordability, specifically dealing with the housing gap that exists in our community. And we all know the issues of inequality and division are difficult to talk about. And at Leadership Austin, we value all points of view. So thank you for joining us for this dialogue today. Before we get started, I'd like to recognize and thank our sponsors. If you look at your table, there is a signage that shows all our sponsors on there. And also special thanks to the Long Center and KXAN and our presenting sponsor, Austin Board of Realtors. Let's give them a big hand, please. At this time, I would like to invite a friend of mine to come over here. He's a great community leader. He's very engaged in this community, and he's a very good friend of mine. And, you know, best of all, he's a CEO of Austin Board of Realtors. So, Mr. Paul Hilgers.
Thank you. Good morning. I don't feel as bad as I sound this morning, but I do feel I am sounding a little froggy this morning. Wow, what a crowd. Congratulations for making the decision to be engaged. I'd like to ask three questions, really. First, if this is your first time here at an engaged breakfast, please raise your hand.
Wow.
Isn't that awesome? I mean, this happens every time. Yeah, give him an applause. Secondly, if you are a realtor, please raise your hand. See? Shocks you, huh? They're everywhere. We're all through the community. And then the third question is, if you are now on the board of directors of the Austin Board of Realtors, would you please raise your hand? Not you, Lori. You're on every other committee, so... I just want you to see that the Austin Board of Realtors is a part of this community. It is engaged itself, and we are trying very hard to continue to increase our engagement. And there's no better vehicle to do that than through this breakfast and through our partnership with Leadership Austin. This issue is a critical issue. You have really smart people here to help guide us through a conversation that is a difficult one. The issue of housing is so complex, it is one that has, as I've said before, target populations within target populations, industries within industries, and you have a very difficult time trying to find a coherent approach to address the multitude of issues that create the lack of affordability in our community. And only by educating ourselves to the very mundane, very difficult issues of things like the Land Development Code and the rewrite of the Land Development Code and the impact on the uncertainty that creates in this market for the building community can we address these issues. So Austin Board of Realtors is proud to be a presenting sponsor. We're proud of our partnership. I also am always transitioning this over by saying how proud we are to be a partner with KXAN in this particular venue. KXAN has not only provided leadership in this particular series and increased their news coverage of these topics, which they don't have to do. But they do that because they're very committed to this community. If you want to know what's going on in Austin and beyond a soundbite, then you can tune into KXAN because they always give you more in-depth coverage about the critical issues facing our community. This is one of them. Shannon, I turn it over to you, and thank you all very much.
I did not tell Paul to say all of that, but it is all true. So, Paul, thank you very much. Obviously, at KXAN, we are so honored to be part of this series. Part of our core purpose at KXAN is to help enrich the community. And if you've been to one of these breakfasts, you've heard me say that before. But it is absolutely true, and we feel like this is one of the best ways for us to do that. So, I want to just quickly get started this morning. A quick intro. I'm going to introduce our panelists, and then we're going to get going because an hour goes by very quickly, especially on a topic like this one. So I think we can all agree, right, that Austin is growing more and more expensive. There's no denying the cost of living continues to increase because so many people want to live in this region. We also know that while affordability is an issue that affects all of us, the impact is a lot more substantial for some people in our community than it is for others, which is why this topic is really such a crucial part of this Growing Divide series. If we agree on the problem, we can also agree on a plan to tackle it. So the questions are, is density the answer? How do we protect our already existing neighborhoods? Very important, I know, to a lot of people. So here to help us develop a deeper understanding of both the causes and the possible solutions surrounding affordability are three housing experts in Austin. We are excited and honored to have a new city council member in each of these discussions about Austin's growing divide. And today we are joined by council member Sherry Gallo, who represents District 10. She brings with her 35 years of experience as a residential realtor and the vision to both control affordability and protect the character of Austin neighborhoods. Sherry, thank you for being here this morning. Also here to share with us his perspective regarding urban development and density as a tool for affordability is Terry Mitchell. As president of Momark Development, Terry has been heavily involved in the planning and development of various residential and mixed-use real estate developments, including the Austonian and Chestnut Commons. He also serves on the board for Housing Works Austin, an affordable housing advocacy organization. Terry, thank you so much for being here this morning. Ward Tisdale is the president of the Real Estate Council of Austin, and as an advocacy organization for the Central Texas commercial real estate industry, they recently published a white paper addressing affordability in Austin, and Ward is here to share the research behind that report and its intended outcomes. So, Ward, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
And finally, on behalf of a very important piece of the dialogue today, my colleague David Scott is here. He represents your voice in this discussion today, and this is very important. And it's very important especially to me because I think audience participation in these breakfasts is crucial. David is going to let you join the conversation through text message. If you text 22333 and enter ENG1415 at the beginning of your question, those questions will go to David, and I will go to him periodically throughout the discussion. And those instructions are in the center of your table if you didn't write that down. I know so many of you did. You cannot yell. Okay, so we're going to get started this morning. And the first question I want to ask, obviously, is when it comes to affordable housing, the growing divide, affordability for all, how did we get here? And what has led up to Austin becoming the most expensive city in Texas to live? And I'd like to start with Sherry and go down the row.
Great question, and there's not a short answer to it. As you mentioned, I've been in residential real estate for the past 35 years, and it seems like Austin cycles about every 10 years with the economy. And so our housing expense corrects itself a bit about every 10 years. But what I'm seeing in this cycle is that we've had more rapid appreciation than we have had in the past 35 years. And the cycle seems to be continuing. We had a little bit of an adjustment in 09, 10, and 11. But for the last 10 years in Austin, we've seen housing appreciate from anywhere from 50, 60% up to 100%. And that is substantial. I look at my family, both of my grown children work in central Austin. Neither one of them can afford to purchase a home in Austin. So they lease in the areas that they live. And even the rental prices are going up substantially. Although once we talked yesterday a little bit and supply and demand, you know, the problem is that our supply is substantial and our demand is substantial. And our supply is really minimum at this point. Terry?
If some of you guys are tech geeks, there was an article in May or March of 2011 in CNN Money. It was online, and I think it was in the Money magazine, but it was the, at that time, owner of Metro Study, which at that time was the largest residential research firm in the country. It happened to be based in Texas, and the gentleman's name was Mike Castleman, and the article was The Coming Housing Boom. And he was talking about it from a business perspective, but he said we are going to be facing the worst housing shortage nationwide that we've ever had. And his rationale was, in 2008, when the capital markets froze up and we had our big economic collapse, housing industry over a two-year period or whatever, housing starts, and I'm talking about both any type of housing, multifamily or single family, nationwide the average drop was about 80%. Austin was about 60%, but 80% nationwide. And if you know about any of you in the construction business or real estate business, or if you've seen out there, you know, a company like mine, we have 6 employees. And when we're working on a project, there may be 400 out there, but they're all subcontractors. There's tile guys. There's all these people doing stuff. And if they don't have work, they go do something else. And there's another article in May, and I actually tried to find it this morning, and I'm not a tech savvy guy and couldn't find it. I've saved it somewhere so I can help it. But it was talking about the article was about a little town in Oregon, and it was talking about that they had all, you know, there was been 20% unemployment because the largest employer was a lumber mill. And in that article, they quoted, and I'm just giving an example of what happened. They said in 2006, there were 150-something operating lumber mills across the country, and in May of 2013, there were like 14. And so as we're now about nationwide at about 80% of what we historically have averaged for 40 years, it feels like we're at 200%. Every time you start a job, costs have gone up. I'm bidding a new project right now, and I'm trying to do some of the things that we're talking about today. And I've had more than one contractor say in the last 2 years, costs in Austin, Texas have gone up around 30% in 2 years. Just costs. And so we have investors, you know, there are gods, investor gods, and we got to turn around and they want a return, so the project doesn't happen. So we have no choice. We raise our prices. If the market lets us, we raise our prices. If the numbers don't work, it doesn't get built. Plain and simple. So nationwide, every city is facing, I'm on several listservs and I get this information every day, and they'll talk about prices going up and shortages here and shortages there. It's a nationwide phenomenon. Then couple that with Austin's economy being the first or second strongest economy in the nation for the last 5 years. We never hit a real downturn in terms of we were zero job growth in 2009, which is the lowest we've had in the last 20 years, and we grew 55,000 people. Right, they got to live somewhere. So, any condition we had in our inventory that was sort of the cushion began to be eaten away. If you look at our growth rate today, and this is my estimation, and there's economists out here that'll give you much more detailed information, but at our present growth rate, I kind of, as a rule of thumb, think we need 20,000 to 23,000 new housing units, whether that's for sale or whether that's for rent, to house it. And that's a simple math deal of taking your population growth and dividing by an average household size of 2.4 to 2.6 people. And I'm not talking about Austin, I'm talking about metropolitan area. Why? That's where you get the number. We hadn't hit that until this year. So for the last 4 years, it's been getting tighter and tighter and tighter. Economics 101, when demand goes up and supply gets tight, what happens to price? It goes up. So that's what's happened. And the challenge we face, in my opinion, is our median family incomes, and this is, again, a nationwide phenomenon. It's unique to Austin. Incomes are relatively flat. If you look at our median family income and you pull up the neighborhood housing's deal, and it'll change in March, but from May of 2007 to May of 2014, our average household income has declined. Ever so slightly, but declined, and housing costs have gone up 30%. It's a real challenge. So,
Ward, can you address?
I think they've pretty much nailed everything. I do want to point out one thing that Terry said. We are the economic engine of this country, and thank God for that. I think we all benefit from that. Provides opportunity. I think everyone in this room is probably benefiting. As a parent, I'm so happy Austin is the way it is today, as opposed to, say, 30 years ago when there wasn't the opportunity that we have today. But there is a cost to that. We have more people living here, moving here, that have more money than they ever did before. That's obviously going to have an impact on prices. So that's one issue, growth that comes with that. Our white paper, which you can find at RICA.org, join RICA, and then you can download the white paper. we're growing. Let's face it, 570,000 in the region since 2000. But the supply, as has been pointed out, hasn't kept pace. And really, the essence of our white paper is twofold. One, we need more supply in the city limits. If you look at the growth, this is from the ABJ, we're growing a donut in this community. All the growth is in the suburbs, which suburbs are great. And there's in no way is this bashing suburbs. They provide a valuable function in society. But we need to have more growth in the city center. And not just more supply, but different kinds of things. The so-called missing middle that is talked about quite a bit in the community. So those are the few issues that I'd point out.
So I'm curious to hear all of your thoughts on continued growth in Austin. If we're having a hard time keeping up now, we know more people are just going to continue to move here. So is continued growth something that we should be encouraging? And really, can we afford to keep growing? And Ward, let's start with you.
Yes, grow, absolutely. I think one of the problems we've had in this community for the last several decades is this growth versus no growth fight. And what happens is the focus is on that issue, yet we're still growing, and so we're not planning, and we're not investing in infrastructure. We're not building to the point we have to. So it's not a question of should we grow or not, it's how we grow. And luckily, I got a lot of props today. We have this amazing plan called Imagine Austin. And kudos to folks in the city. I know there are some in this room that worked on this. This is how we're going to get to be a sustainable, wonderful city in the future, by becoming more compact, more connected, a greater focus on the environment. We have the plan. It's right here in this book. And so we just need to stick to the plan. Code Next is coming up, as Paul mentioned earlier. Great opportunity to reorient the land code to support Imagine Austin. But the blueprint is right here in front of us. We just have to execute on it.
Terry?
When I started getting involved in civic activities, which was a good 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it was all about housing. And I joined an affordable housing committee, didn't know anything about it, and got knee-deep in it real quickly. And some amazing people, thank you, Paul Hilgers and other folks, that just began to open my eyes as to, one, what the needs were, and two, the direct but unintended consequences of what we're doing. And so pretty soon I was giving some talks on affordable housing. But I was sitting in meetings like this, and then they started talking about transportation, and there's incredibly strong links between transportation and housing. When he points out that the suburbs are the fastest growing area, well, guess where most of the jobs are? In their urban cores, right? And remember, I talked about 20 to 23,000 people. About 57% of our population owns a home. So roughly 11,000 of those houses are generally occurring in the perimeter and they all got to get to work. So every time, you know, we sell a house in one of these places and they're working in the core, we just added, you know, added to our traffic issue, and we're going, well, why is this happening? Why is this happening? It's our structural way we're growing, if that makes any sense. Imagine Austin talks about creating a variety of downtowns or density nodes so that not everybody has to drive to the core of our city. That's, and it's the single greatest tool we have to help our transportation, in my humble opinion. The third thing, and I'm getting to your question, so I had to lay the predicate. The third thing that I've begun to learn over the last 3 or 4 years is how a city grows greatly affects their financial obligations. There's an organization that I want you to look up, and I have no affiliation with it, but they're just educating me. It's called strongtowns.org. And they are advocating, their advocacy is for cities to become financially strong. And what they basically talk is, for the last 50 years, especially newer cities, especially high-growth newer cities, put in parentheses, Austin, after a period of time, they are facing tremendous financial pressures because the way they have grown is really difficult to sustain. And let me give you an example. If I'm making a very comfortable income of $100,000 a year, and I win the lottery and go buy a $10 million house, taxes are $250,000. The maintenance on that puppy is going to be $50,000 or $60,000. The electric bill is going to be huge. Where I can't sustain it. Even though I have a good income, my obligations are too great. What's happening now in cities like Austin, and that's what this organization, is, nonprofit, is talking about trying to educate cities, is that when you grow in that manner, while it's great on the front end because you all of a sudden add, you know, 300 homes at $200,000 a piece, that's $60 million, we got new tax base, that's good, but 20 or 30 years from now, you got to replace the pipes, you got to replace the roads, you got to replace, and that's multiples over the original cost. And they call it hidden legacy costs, and Austin has a lot of it. And he asked a question one time, and I about wet my pants because he said, "Are you in a city?" I was listening to a podcast. He said, "Are you in a city where your services are going down and your taxes are going up?" He said, "You're a sprawl city, and this is hitting you." And his issue is don't beat yourself up or whatever. That's the way we grew as a suburban city. That's just what we did. And I did 18,000 suburban units. You can paint Mr. Sprawl on my forehead. I'm the guy. I'm one of the guys. But I'm leaving legacy obligations that these people have to go in and take care of. And in 2012, for example, Austin had out on the bond issue $260 million for road repairs. We gave them $30 because that's what we could afford. So my point is, we have to grow. We have to grow. If we stop, those obligations don't start. I mean, don't stop. But how we grow is critically important to our financial future and our transportation future, and in my opinion, our affordable housing future.
So Sherry, as somebody who clearly can have an impact on planning for the future, how do you feel like we should grow responsibly and also make more supply?
Well, the supply is the issue, and we don't have the supply for the residents that we have here right now. And as we continue to grow, then we have to provide that supply also. So the reality is, as you spoke about, is that people, because they can choose, and we've always done this, and people have always done this, you can choose a location that is more inner Austin, inner city Austin, which we all know has always been more expensive than something that's a little bit further out. In the past, that little bit further out has been one or two neighborhoods over, and now it's not. Now it's in a an area that's outside of Austin, whether that's Cedar Park or Lakeway or Bastrop or Buda. But those areas that you have to go to get that difference in size that you're looking for compared to the location being center has gotten further away. And I was glad Terry or Ward mentioned the point that the problem that exists with that is with that sprawl, people still work typically within Austin. So we now have dumped all these people back on our roadways. We all know the effect of that. We're at gridlocked roadways. And you're having to go further and further away to get the type of property that you want to either lease or purchase. And so the business centers, where now they've been so located central Austin, if we can work on having business centers spread out where people can still live and get the type of housing they want in the outer areas, then they will be able able to work closer to home, and less of them will be put on our roadways. So that's the first issue, is the reality that we haven't supplied the affordable housing within the city that can handle the demand that's out there, that people are being forced to live further and further away to get the type of property or the size of property they want to live in. The second issue is the difficulty in building affordable units. You know, over half of our market in Austin are renters. This group probably is more heavily leaned towards property ownership and home ownership, but renters. Just within the last 2 to 3 weeks sitting on the council, we're looking at 2 or 3 affordable housing multifamily projects that are coming on board. And already what I hear is, here is an entity that's ready to build an affordable housing multifamily. And apartments are the fastest way, multifamily is the fastest way to provide affordable housing to the residents of Austin. But already what I'm hearing is there's one project on the northeast side that's zoned for multifamily with a conditional overlay, but the neighborhood wants to see retail involved. So we hit a roadblock. We're hitting a roadblock because you have a company that's willing to provide that multifamily, but the neighborhood is stepping in, even though the property is zoned for multifamily, saying, you know, wait a second, we'd like to see some retail. We have another project that's being proposed on the west side, and the neighborhoods are stepping in and saying, but the issue with this is it's affordable housing, but we don't have the transit system, the bus system going out to that area that can help provide transportation. So as we put up roadblocks, right or wrong, correct or not, with the information that's coming in to make the determination of whether to approve those or not, we continue to hit those roadblocks from the population in the neighborhoods. And so we talk about building affordable housing, but already just within the first couple of weeks of being on the council, there are always people that say, yes, that's great, but wait a second. And so we really need to have a consensus of opinion. Once again, Imagine Austin is a good step towards that, but where we all buy into the idea that we've got to build those affordable housing units.
David, I'd like to get a question from the audience, if we could.
Yeah, one of the we're all very familiar. Good morning, by the way. apologies for any inconvenience by starting this 5 minutes early. Laura Presley, please don't sue. I got here a couple minutes late because of my long commute from far Bell County, where it is affordable. I'm kidding. Sherry Gallo, you were part of an historic 10-member district elected council. We previously had 6 at-large seats. Folks may be perhaps cut of the same cloth. Now we've got 10 practicable, hard-headed people, each looking out for their own turf. If they couldn't do anything with affordability, how will you? And what is the first common ground you anticipate some progress amongst you 10 on affordability?
You know, it's interesting because all of us ran very busy races that were very segregated. So there were not many, if any, forums where we actually had a chance to hear the other candidates in the different races. And so this opportunity over the last handful of weeks has really been the first opportunity to get to know the other council members. And at least what my intuition is and my perception is, I think Austin will find that the council members form a lot of partnerships and coalitions that are unexpected. And it shouldn't be, because I think all of us, even though we have been elected from different districts in Austin, we all represent the interest of all of Austin. And the lack of attention to core services and providing what's needed in the different districts, I think, are going to mirror each other from district to district. So I do think there's going to be a lot of consensus with providing core services that have been underserved in most of the areas of Austin, and also really addressing the affordable housing in all of the areas of Austin.
Oh, again, we would encourage your text questions, ENG 1415, and then just put in your question to 22333. Terry, one of the suggestions and questions is, why not go in the centralized area to more things like garage apartments, granny flats, bungalow courts, small things that could help with the density, but that don't raise the profit that maybe a lot of developers would like to see. Is that a partial solution, at least, and will developers be willing to provide that sort of affordable housing?
As a developer, and if anybody has any other tools, give them to me. But I have, you know, my job's to serve you guys and your children and your parents and everyone else that you know. And so, you know, I look for tools that we can do, and I have two tools to answer that question specifically. I have density and I have square footage. If you want to see the answer to the test, go to places like Hong Kong and Tokyo and London, where the average family lives in 450 square feet, to make it affordable. All right, that's a challenge, and it's a whole different game. It's like living in a sailboat or something. You know, it's really different. But to granny flats is, if you had, and I want to say Seattle has this, but if you had a blanket wide granny flats with appropriate restrictions, appropriate whatever, I think you would see a lot of them. Because it is a way for a senior to put a unit in the back and help pay their taxes on a fixed income. It's you know, somebody who needs to supplement their income and give them the opportunity to have a little rental income. In the very high cost areas in California, you're seeing the family that owned the house build a small unit in the back, and they move back in the small unit and rent the front, or you know, sell it as they reach maturity and their incomes flatten out or whatever. It is a very viable option if it's done appropriately, and if it's done where it does not, you know, it doesn't work if you call a granny flat a 2,000 square foot three story unit in the back. I mean, that's multifamily housing, you know, that's urban townhomes. There is a trend nationwide where people are living smaller, and that's one of the tools in a lot of these areas that they're doing. And they're literally living in 200 to 500 square feet and just making it live better. You know, they'll make the ceilings 12 feet high, and they'll do a loft bed. And so while it may be 300 square feet, it lives like it's 500 square feet because the bedroom's in the roof, you know, kind of stuff. So, yes, that's a very, very viable option. And in my opinion, if it's done well and you don't see it, I mean, Pemberton has granny flats. You know, Tarrytown has granny flats. I got a block down the street is a granny flat house from our neighbor, and they for years used it as rental income. You know,
and Terry, I don't want to interrupt you, yeah, but I do want to get to, yeah, kind of Ward's point yesterday, which is there is a very generational divide when it comes to this issue. So as we move forward in this city, Ward, you were talking about that may be a more viable option in the future.
Yeah, I believe the, and this is in our white paper as well, that the predominant households in Austin are either single member or couples with no kids. So the demographics are changing. People aren't having kids as they did in the past. They don't need as much space. They want less space. They want, you know, to live more light. So I think the demand for this kind of housing is only going to increase as the millennial generation ages and gets in positions of power. The whole granny flat issue kind of boggles my mind, the fact that it's not already on the books. You know, there are parts of town, as Terry mentioned, that where it is legal, and there's parts of town where it isn't. And that, to me, fundamentally makes no sense. So Councilmember Gallo will have an opportunity to have an impact on that, and I know she'll do the right thing. But that's the kind of low-hanging fruit. I think Chris Riley, when he was pushing for this, called it invisible density because it's, you know, it's an existing lot. So those are the kind of things we need to get going here in Austin.
Ward, I've got a two-part question for you regarding inventory and traffic. Your excellent white paper suggests that we'll need 100,000 new units of housing to come online over the next decade. 100,000, that's 10,000 a year on average. Just to kind of stay afloat with the affordability question, what if through some hiccup or other that doesn't happen? Isn't anything else we try going to be moot? And secondly, in conjunction with that, how much is the seemingly intractable traffic congestion contributing to the desire to remain in the central area?
Well, the traffic really is a function of sprawl. As has been mentioned, the jobs are in Austin. The growth is outside. Bingo. You got a congestion problem. We do argue for actually 87,000 new units by 2025 to kind of stabilize things. 100,000 we think can actually put a downward pressure on prices. But the one thing we haven't really talked about here, and it's very important to me, is transit. We had a vote in November. It failed. I'm personally on the day 23 of a 30-day journey to get around town without my truck. And it's been a lot of fun, actually. So I've been taking the bus every day and car to go and B-cycle. And it's sort of John Candy playing.
Pressure's on
that. So I've enjoyed that, but we need to work on our transit system. You know, buses are okay, and we can, you know, I think BRT has been a success so far. We can expand those routes. We don't have to wait for another rail proposition. That may not be the right solution, but we've got to work on our public transit system in this region.
I'd like to kind of get into a topic that's a little bit more difficult to discuss, and that really is your thoughts about, as we tackle affordability, how do we make sure that we're not becoming a more divided city? People who want to live in town or in East Austin are not getting pushed out of their homes. Sherry.
I will answer that, but I want to answer a quick question about the granny flats issue. Is the advantage of being born and living in Austin for my entire life is I've been able to see kind of the cycles of legislation and zoning changes. And it used to be that single-family zoning allowed a second unit on the property. And so people did go in and build a duplex that was connected. Or what I think we probably should, instead of granny flats, maybe come up with a different name. But because it would probably be marketed to the non-granny part of our population.
Right.
Who would not like being called grannies. But both of my kids went to school in Lubbock at Texas Tech, and the city of Lubbock back in the 30s and 40s had a real need for housing, small housing, efficiency in one-bedroom units for both the military base that was there and the school that was growing. And so they came in and encouraged building of the back houses, which is what they're called. And it's a wonderful opportunity for not only owners to have an additional source of income, but to provide housing in those small types of dwellings that are very, very affordable. So Austin used to allow that, but through our zoning changes, we've not been doing that. So we have in the past. It's obvious that we need to do this again for the future and get back to the way things were done. So I just wanted to tag on to that. We have done it, and we should do it again.
No, that's
divide.
Great. Yes.
You know, there's always, it's when we talk about the East and West divide in Austin, it's always surprised me how long it has taken for the East Central Austin to develop. I mean, it is so convenient, so close to UT, so close to downtown. There was some development back in the 80s, and then it kind of stopped for a little bit. But it's surprising, actually, that it's taken this long to take off. The difficulty and the concern and the caution that we need to have with this rapid appreciation in that area is, how does it displace the people that have been there forever? And typically, they're displaced because their cost to continue to live there is more than they can afford. And that would certainly be taxes. So I think the property tax issue for the people that are being displaced because all of a sudden their area has appreciated so rapidly. I mean, if they've been there 30, 40 years and it's a family home that's been passed down, it really doesn't make any difference to them what it's worth if they don't want to leave the neighborhood. But when we're forcing people to leave because it's unaffordable for them to be able to stay there, then that's part of the issue that we really, really do need to speak about and listen to and come up with a solution for.
Mm-hmm. David?
The white paper that you guys put out noted that in October of last year there were exactly 88 homes on the market for sale asking $180,000 or less. A third of the homes for sale were asking upwards of $300,000 and beyond. Money goes where profits are. How do you fight the free marketplace urges and desires? I mean, can we manipulate that through government edict, for example? And to Sherry in particular, should each of the 10 new districts bear their burden of a quota, say, of mandated affordability, or is it going to be left to certain districts that are less affluent than others?
Those are a lot of questions in one.
Time is short.
First of all, I do not think government should mandate free market. I think that is a policy position that we don't want to be in. I think free market, if we leave it to make responsible, good decisions and service the demand that is there, is the healthiest way to proceed forward. Affordable housing units, you know, the reality is you start with the land price. The land price differs substantially from areas of Austin, and then you build what the market will bear. And so mandating that affordable housing units be put in certain areas of Austin, if it services a demand that's there, I think it's appropriate. If it's forced to be there just because you want to have that geographic representation, I think you have to be very careful with that. But we certainly have, you know, affordability, and I say this over and over again, it's not a dollar amount. It's not a dollar that makes it affordable or not. It's the percentage and the relationship of your income to your expenses. You know, I represent District 10, which is one of the wealthiest, most affluent districts in Austin. But we have affordability issues in District 10. We have children that are graduating from college that can't afford to live in the areas they grew up in. We have seniors that are being forced out of their homes because their property taxes and utilities have gotten out of control. So, yes, we need affordable area. We need affordable developments in all areas of Austin.
So I'd like to know specifically from each of you, I mean, this is obviously a Sherry question, you know, but specifically, let's talk about some specifics. What can our new city council do to make housing more affordable in Austin? And maybe I'll start with Ward. What do you think the city council should do?
Well, the first thing they can do is adhere to this plan, Imagine Austin. The code rewrite, as I mentioned, is in effect. Let's make sure that code matches the plan. So that is a high-level thing that the council can absolutely do. Policies that help supply, the so-called, well, we're not calling them granny flats anymore, but the garage apartments, cottages.
Back houses.
You know, again, that's just an easy example. And to David's question on the fact that prices are going up, again, we'll say again, it's a supply issue. We're not providing enough supply to the market and not enough creative types of solutions other than single family and multifamily. We need that, again, missing middle type products. I do want to, my third prop of the day is, this was Shonda Novak in the Statesman the other day. Supply is actually starting to have an effect. Things are coming on market, prices are stabilizing, in fact going down. So this is proof that this works. The private sector can solve this problem.
Terry, what do you think the council could and should do to address this issue?
As a private, well, let me talk a little bit about single family. Most people who come to me and say, how can we reduce the cost of a single family home? In 1993, when I started to develop metropolitan area wide, whether it was Austin or the suburbs, my average lot cost was about $14,000. Fast forward to today, and it doesn't matter whether you're in Liberty Hill or Manor or Bastrop or Austin, you're not going to find land for under about the land component of about $10,000 to $12,000 a unit is pretty typical. And then your lot cost, that 14 comparison, is now $1,200 to $1,300 a running foot. So if it's a 50-foot lot, which is considered a relatively small lot, multiply it times $1,300 a foot, and you're looking at $80,000-something, which means you're building a $300,000 home. That's the lowest it can get. And so without, you know, you can't do it any lower. It's just the costs are what they are. And so the two tools that I have are density and square footage. You know, I'm working on a condo project that will hopefully start soon, and my average square footage is 876 square feet. You know, and a few people raise their eyebrows and say, no one can live in that. Well, I beg to differ. Until I was 12, my family of four lived in 850 square feet, two-bedroom, one-bath house. My parents got married very early, and by the way, most of my time was spent outside the house. You know, I think my mom said, come home at 5 and stay out of the house, whatever. But it's what we do. Now, this is not unique to Austin. Every high-cost city has the same issue. If you want to go to San Diego and find affordable housing, it's density. If you want to go to San Francisco, it's even higher density and really small, 200 square feet. It's just the reality.
Sherry, I know you have some feelings about density, so can you talk about that?
Absolutely. But first I want to say there are certain things that we can do in the city government to affect the process. And one of the things that adds to the cost is the length of the process. It takes too long to get projects through the city departments, and that can be fixed. So that's the very first thing that we can do. Actually, and that's one of those amazing projects and processes that would be at no cost to the city taxpayers and actually save people money and certainly save in the building process. So that would be the thing, is speed up the process. The other thing that we need to do as we make policy decisions is every regulation or ordinance that's proposed needs to have an evaluation for the cost effect. We propose things, and I know the builders have put out information over the last couple of years with all the new regulations and ordinances that affect them, that it's added about $10,000 to the cost of a house. As we make those policy decisions, we need to make them knowing the effect that it has to the taxpayers of Austin. So that's the other piece that I think has been missing from the policy decisions at the city. And then your question was, I'm sorry.
Just if you could address what Terry was talking about when it comes to density.
Well, as Terry said, in order to provide a product when the cost to do the product is more expensive, it has to be smaller. And I do think we have a population. I mean, my kids are in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and they are willing to live in smaller units to be where they want to be and to be able to walk to work or walk to where they want to go out and eat for dinner. And if we provide that, then we have serviced that part of the population. But the existing residents that live in those areas have to be comfortable with allowing that increase in density to happen. So it's the issue of neighborhoods being willing to participate in this project of providing affordable housing to probably the younger generation of our community. And also, we have to make sure that these are projects that enhance those neighborhoods, that we're not just doing things and not listening to the neighborhood residents, but we're doing things that the neighborhoods have bought into and understand that there's a benefit to.
Terry?
Just as a side note, when I'm talking about density, what I did not say is density anywhere. I mean, it's not appropriate to put a five-story building next door to a single-family house and totally change the character and the what's going on there. I would say appropriate density and appropriate locations, you know, and it's not gonna cover the waterfront, but you have to think about it in the right locations, if that makes any sense. Because there's certainly, you don't want to get rid of single-family housing. That will always be a staple of our housing stock. But so density has to occur in the right locations in the right density.
David, audience question?
Yeah, this is regarding the boom, this seemingly irreversible boom that we're having in values and growth. I think I remember it was the late 80s here when there was a smaller boomlet downtown and it looked like things were going to take off, and then for whatever energy reasons or the rest, that didn't manifest itself. Now it appears this boom that we're having is irreversible, and that is, of course, rising the tide and rising the prices. Do you see this irreversibly continuing? If so, what impact does it have, and should it slow for whatever reason? Is there a silver lining in any of that to any of you?
Well, Terry could probably talk about cycles because they happen and he's been through many of them. But this boom will end at some point. I mean, that's just the reality that life goes in cycles. I mean, who predicted 9/11 and the impact that had on the economy? So I'm not hoping for that. But, you know, at some point, you know, that something is going to be, there will be a correction at some point. I wanted to just make one comment about rising property values. And that's just to say that just because properties values rise does not mean taxes necessarily have to rise at the same level. You could actually reduce a tax rate. I'm referring to the governmental entities. So that's something we don't talk about enough, but just because values go up does not mean taxes necessarily have to go in that same level. So,
David, the fastest growing metropolitan area in the United States in the 50s was Detroit, and I think they're, you know, while they're in a little bit of a recovery mode because things are incredibly inexpensive, it's probably not something we would want to go through. But it's a certainty that our rapid growth rate will slow, and it will slow either because technology is no longer needed, but it may well grow, may well slow because things have become unaffordable, and we fight the San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Boston issues. I have a daughter that lives in Boston. She lives in a 300 square foot apartment for $1,450 a month. She doesn't have a car. She can walk everywhere, and she loves it. It's a lifestyle, but my analytical brain starts going, how do you live here? How do you like it? But it's just the reality. It's just the reality. And so I think it's going to slow down. I hope we don't ever have a Detroit issue. I think we need to manage it. And my hope is that we have a moderate growth that's manageable, and we set on a course like Imagine Austin or something that will help manage our issues.
You know, the word manageable is really important in all of this discussion, I think. And, you know, having been from this community for so long and seen the cycles, and we do have cycles, and what goes up will come down. The concerning factor to me right now is that our growth and our appreciation in the past has been manageable and been moderate. We haven't had the rapid appreciation that we saw on the East and West Coast, so that when the economies went down, prices plummeted. Limited. You know, we had adjustments, but they weren't huge, substantial adjustments. The concern that I have now is because of the rapid appreciation and the rapid growth that we're looking at, is that if we turn the corner and head the other direction, that we may look at mirroring what has happened in some of the other areas on the East Coast and West Coast where the down is substantial. So hopefully we won't be there, but this is a different cycle from what we've seen in the past. And we just really need to position ourselves to try to keep that from happening if we can. So moderation, you know, our parents always said that. Moderation's good. It really is.
What do you all feel like when it comes to the solutions to this issue? Because we know there are many. What do you feel like are some competing viewpoints that are working against each other to make our housing situation less affordable? Ward?
Okay. Well, I think it's been brought up. There are projects that come up throughout the city that sometimes don't get the support from the neighborhood that the developer or the project lead would want, and those are legitimate concerns. We all live in neighborhoods. We all want to make sure we protect it. But that kind of back and forth does delay things. As Sherry mentioned, the review process in the city is dysfunctional and needs to be corrected. So that's another opposing force. And so those things just tend to add more cost to each project and delay and prevent us from getting to where we need to be. Those are a couple factors.
Terry?
I'll talk a little bit about the regulatory side of it. I think the City of Austin staff is some of the brightest and smartest and most creative people you'll see. That being said, when you go in to submit a project, you're looking at maybe 22 different reviewers or whatever, and many times they'll give you a comment, and the comment really may make their life easier, may help. I'll give you one example, and I'm not trying to pick on them. I think they're good folks. But the Water and Wastewater Department, 15 years ago, the standard easement was 15 feet, and then it was 20 feet for about 15 years. Most recently it was 25 feet, and then I was told yesterday that they're asking for 30 feet. Well, in a little project that I'm doing, I probably lose 20% of my density by going to 30 feet. And it's like, And so when I ask why you need that easement, they go, "Oh, we need more room. We got equipment, whatever." And I said, "Man, can't you guys drive and, you know, stay within 25 feet? I'll buy you pieces. We'll get a community. We'll raise money. We'll buy you a piece of smaller equipment so that we can get it in there." Because the ultimate thing is you're raising the cost of housing. And it's just that those indirect things cost a lot. And it's not just, and I'm not picking on them, that's just one simple example, but whether it's, you know, just a myriad of issues, but those things, they're doing what's best for their department, but if the overall goal is affordable housing, et cetera, there's lots of things then are driving up that cost, if that makes any sense.
I want to ask about the starter home wannabes, because we always encourage new blood coming into the ownership marketplace, and as prices have risen for that, they're forced to rent, then caught between a rock and a hard place because rents keep going up until the inventory helps out. Is there a ratio that's an ideal balance between renting and owning in the city, and where are we in relationship to that ideal ratio?
Well, metropolitan area-wide, 57% of our population owns a home. If it's in the city of Austin, it's under 50% because we're a higher cost
region. Is that a good ratio?
Pretty typical for a large city. San Diego, it's like 20%. It's smaller than that. And so it just depends upon the length of the city and the prices in relation to incomes. But it's, for a larger city, it's not atypical. Dallas and Houston have higher ownership percentages. Phoenix has a higher ownership percentage, but some of the higher, Seattle has a lower percentage, Portland has a lower percentage. I couldn't directly answer that if it's right or wrong.
You know, the Austin ratio has been the same for decades, and so it's not really deviated much from that. I think a lot of it is that we have a young transient population that lives here. The other thing is that renting is much more affordable than home ownership, and so as home ownership costs goes up, once again, a part of the population can choose a more affordable lifestyle. Their expenses are controlled because if their hot water heater goes out, they call their landlord instead of having to have that money come out of their savings. So, it's the same as it's been for as long as I've been involved with the Apartment Association. I mean, those are the numbers that we've tracked for three decades now.
I think part of it is we have a large university in the central part of the city. So there's 52,000 typically renters starting off with. And then we have an urban population that is, our average age in Austin is about 32. Nationwide, most cities are 36. So we have a younger population. And they like to be in the core of the city. And so they rent to do that. And so I think those are factors that probably, bring it down some.
Going back to property taxes, we haven't had significant reform on that since the legislature acted in, I believe, 2006. They're talking about it now. How significant a role, considering all the other factors there are in rising costs, how significant are property taxes to making things affordable? And are you liking what you're hearing in these early days from the legislature this time? Would lower price? I mean, is that just when you consider the cost of land and building and regulation and all the rest? Are property taxes really a significant contributing factor?
We talked about that.
I'll jump in on that. Yes, the answer is I think property taxes do affect affordability. You know, one of the things that I was just amazed by was when we did there were a lot of informational forums that were done for the candidates last year, and I vividly remember one that the city departments came in and did. And city departments do a good job, but I was just absolutely amazed that their projection over the next handful of years was an automatic increase in their budgets. And I think that culture of assuming that everything has to go up as far as the operational cost of your city government and your city departments is absolutely the wrong thought process. And we need to start by changing that culture. The other thing that kind of plays into that is that if a city department doesn't spend their budget, then they have the potential of their budget being cut the next year instead of being rewarded for being cost efficient and watching your tax dollars, because that is our tax dollars that are funding all of that. So So, you know, there's a lot of places within city departments that I think we can go in and start affecting the mindset of being more cautious and being more caring and sensitive to the fact that it really is our dollars that they're spending.
Yeah, we do an annual report called the Cost of Government Index. We've been doing it since RECA has been around for 24 years. And it basically shows that on an annual basis, property taxes go up more than income just about every year. So it is an issue. And as you know, in Texas, we don't have an income tax. So the property taxes, you know, bear more of the burden. But it definitely is part of the overall affordability issue, without a doubt.
Any more questions from the audience?
Yeah, we do.
One more quickly, and then I want to get to the call to action in the end.
Very quickly, we've got a new medical school coming in line. That's going to bring in some more people, and voters rather strongly rejected this rail plan last time around. What impact, if it doesn't look like that's going to be attempted again anytime soon. It was more a dozen years between the last efforts. What impact does that have, and where do we need to go with transit to, will that bring any alleviation to, not renters, but to home, to property owners? Further transit. Yes, sir.
The answer is yes. I have two children in college. One goes to a suburban school in a town of University of Arkansas, 75,000 people in Fayetteville, and the other one goes to a school in Boston. And I just told you the one in Boston pays $1,400 a month for rent. That includes her utilities, includes all her maintenance. She does not own a car. So the average cost of a car in the United States of paying for it, paying for taxes, paying for gas, paying for maintenance, et cetera, is about $9,000 a year. And it's interesting, we send both of those children the same amount of money, and they live about the same, within the same range of spending money, because one of them doesn't have to, one of them's got to pay for their gas, got to pay for all the other stuff on their car, and it just costs more. So yes, it does, it would have a difference if you don't have to own a car, get a $9,000 raise. You know, in that regard.
And I think you all addressed the fact that if we can recruit businesses to headquarter outside of downtown, then that would alleviate a lot of our issues for the people who are wanting to live and work close by. We are almost out of time right now, which it just seems like it flies by. But I'd like to ask each one of you, we call it a call to action if you've never been to the Engage Breakfast before, and that is asking each one of you to share with the audience just one thing that they can do to help be involved and engaged and address this issue. So, Sherry, can we start with you?
There's so many things that you can do to help with the affordability issue. The one thing that I try to promote and convey over and over again is when people hear the term affordable, you know, in a lot of people's mind, that means low income and crime and, you know, all of those aspects that are negative. And when my daughter moved back here to Austin, she was in news broadcasting. The 60% median income for a family of one, is about $31,000, $32,000. She was hired to work here in Austin for $34,000. She had been in broadcasting for 3 years. She was a professional. She had graduated from college. So I say this only to say that when we talk about affordable housing, that it's the young people entering the workforce. It's the seniors that are on fixed income. And if you can do something to help promote and convey that affordable is not negative, that it really is positive from the standpoint that it helps those entry-level people getting into the market, the people that have come back into the market that are starting at entry-level positions, and also the seniors that are now on fixed incomes, that will do more to help convey the positiveness of being able to provide more affordable housing.
Terry, quickly.
I think the greatest thing you can do is do exactly what you're doing and being here and educating yourself. Read about it. Ask questions. Talk to your city council member. Most of the time, in my experience, when we've had big issues like this, we all have the same goal, and that goal is we want to live in a great place. We want Austin to be a great place. We want to be a wonderful place to raise a family, live here, have it be safe, all those things, be affordable to everyone. But we all come at it from different viewpoints. And if you ever read these books, Crucial Conversations or Getting to Yes or whatever, we all have to be operating from the same base of knowledge before we can begin to make decisions together. You know, when somebody comes to me for years when I was doing suburban work, they'd say, we want a 2,000 square foot home and we want an acre lot and we want to pay $75,000. And I said, well, lot's about 100. I'm not sure I would get there. Once you explain that, then they start saying, well, then I'll look at another option. And it was because we began to share information. And so getting involved and learning about these issues, we've got some incredibly bright minds. I mean, 43% of our population has a college degree. We ain't dumb. All right. And so if we educate ourselves, I have a lot of faith in our ability to come up with great solutions.
Ward?
Pretty similar. The best thing is to get involved. Sherry and her colleagues need to hear from you. They will listen. There's no question about it. So, you know, join an advocacy group. As I was joking earlier, you're welcome to join our group. I see my friends from Aura over here. There's a number of organizations, CNU, others in this group, in this community, that are really concerned about these issues and can have an impact. And lastly, you know, again, we have the plan. The plan is here. It just needs to be executed. We're a suburban city for the most part, but we're trying to become an urban city, and we're in that transition. So let's get involved and let's make it happen.
Thank you all so much, and thank you all for being here. Please don't leave. Julie Smith from Leadership Austin has some quick final announcements, really quick.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panel.